It is Saturday, December 2nd, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, our Weekend Geek News segment, followed by a conversation about processors with John Stokes from Ars Technica.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during this program are not necessarily those of KUSP. Heck, they're not necessarily those of ours. We don't know what we're talking about. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA, and Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control. Geeks, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lyle.
All right.
The news will
all
be...
All right.
All right. Man, you are hit.
Like I say, good morning every week.
It was unique. That's
we're
true.
Shaking it up today.
We have John Stokes on. He's Hannibal at Ars Technica, a writer extraordinaire about technology, and he has a new book out called Inside the Machine, all about the processor, an illustrated introduction to macroprocessors and computer architecture. And we'll be talking with him during about 15 minutes, but first we're going to do some news. Mr. Elam, I'd like to start with you.
One of the things that's bugged web developers in the past is the fact that you can only have one version of Internet Explorer installed.
This is on a Windows machine.
Right,
that's
on
right.
A Windows machine. When you're trying to test a website to see if it works, you only have the version that you have running. You couldn't have the other versions.
It actually, recently when I was prompted to update my Windows machine and get IE7, it kind of pained me because I knew if I went to IE7, which I wanted to test, I would no longer have access to IE6 and therefore I wouldn't be able to see the bugs that exist still on the site.
And a lot of developers are having the same worries, because there are going to be a lot of people that get that prompt and say, no, I don't want IE7, which, by the way, to the audience, if you're using Internet Explorer, go to 7.
Yeah.
We do say go to Firefox or Opera, but if you're going to use Internet Explorer, upgrade to the latest version.
Okay, so it has been upsetting. Is there a solution?
Yes, there is. Microsoft has been has made available a virtual PC image. And what this is a computer within a computer. It's a computer contained within software. And making an image of Windows XP with Internet Explorer 6, meaning that on a single computer, you're able to look and view that web page or website that you've created in the two different versions of the browser.
Now, virtual Windows, that means that you have to have two copies of Windows on your computer, right? More hard drive space?
Yes, you do need to have more hard drive space. But then again, today's world of 300 gig hard drives are
sure.
That's not so much of an issue.
I like the idea because that way you don't have to have two machines.
Right, and the idea is that this other image does not have a huge full suite of software. Its sole purpose is so that you have this version of IE6 around.
And is Microsoft doing this for free?
Yes, they are making available for free, but the download is set to expire in April 2007. So who knows if they'll renew it or have a new one.
But maybe something like that. Of course, they're pushing Vista, so it's interesting that they're offering a solution of XP. Is the idea that Vista only comes with IE7, and therefore if you flood the market with IE7, then people will design for it, and then Vista will work better?
Right. In another wrinkle, though, is that, for example, Windows 2000 does not support IE7. However, if you download this image, the virtual PC does run on Windows 2000. So you can run virtual PC, download the XP, and then upgrade the image to have IE7.
How confusing.
So the virtual image inside of
I say, if you're running Windows Server or Windows 2000, which is a server platform, you can't run IE7.
There's Windows 2000 Professional.
Okay,
well.
So you're running Windows 2000. You can't run IE7, but you can install XP in a virtual mode, which is free,
right?
As long as you have a Microsoft operating system, and then you upgrade that to IE7. So everybody wins.
How difficult is that?
Actually, virtual PC is pretty simple.
It's not simple, but I've heard that it's still beta version and it doesn't have all the features that you'd get with VMware.
It's not as good as VMware in that it's not as fast, but it's perfectly reasonable. I mean, it's fine. You run it. It doesn't run quite as fast as, or anywhere near as fast, actually, as your main system.
What are the memory requirements?
You need the RAM for that system. So
if you're desperate to do this, what are the penalties to pay?
Well, if you have 1 gig of RAM, you can run XP just fine, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have two versions of XP, you want to have 2 gigs of RAM.
And that's about it. And you don't want to do anything major.
A processor with virtualization support would help, right?
No, I don't think
You don't require it. It would be
you don't
faster.
Require it, of course, right. But it would be much faster if this processor had it. Well, and, of course, the new processors do.
Right. Thank you very much, Miles.
I've got one here.
Please.
Experts reconstruct Leonardo da Vinci fingerprint. So anthropologists have pieced together his left index fingerprint, and they're looking at what he had for dinner last night, what kind of the night before he put the fingerprint on the manuscript. And it's kind of it's interesting because it's adding some human depth to Leonardo da Vinci that we don't have documented anywhere, such as was his mother of Arabic origin. There seems to be a whirl in the patterns of fingerprints that's genetic from Arabic parents on the female side.
Is the detection of what he ate for dinner the night before is like what kind of grease is on his finger? Or
yeah, I mean, they're looking. This is all speculation. I don't believe there's been anything confirmed, but experts say that his fingerprints could include traces of stuff like saliva, blood, or the food he ate the night before.
I don't get it. How do you know it's his? How do you know it's not somebody else? Like the guy that carried the painting out of the room? You know, I mean, isn't it could have been 100 people?
There's about 200 fingerprints. Most of them are partial that are taken from over 52 papers that he handled throughout his life.
Okay.
So it seems to point to him.
Very cool.
It could be his assistant, I suppose, if there were such a person. I don't know.
All right. Thank you very much, Drew.
It's kind of interesting.
Mr. Cleland.
Yeah, AMD launched their QuadFX platform this past week.
Well, that's the multiple graphics processors?
It's a new processor. It's actually three new processors. These things now run up to 3 gigahertz in speed.
Main processors. I'm sorry. I was stuck in graphics world.
So the FX70, FX72, and FX74 processors, they run at 2.6, 2.8, 3 gigahertz speeds. They have a new package, 1207 pin. So they don't have pins.
New pins? Oh, no.
So it's a LAN pin grid array. They're moving from pins.
A which pin grid array?
LAN pin grid array.
Well, that cleared it up.
LPGA, wow.
So the idea is...
So the way it works is, instead of the processor having pins, that could be bent really easy. Problem with AMD processors right now, especially desktop processors, consumer processors, if you drop it, you could bend the pins. And oftentimes you bend it back, it breaks off, dead processor. You know, that's a lot of money to blow on an accident like that. So the idea is you put the pins on the motherboard. And the processor is flat on the bottom, and it's got these pads. The contact pads. And then you put the processor in a metal device that clamps a lid down, applies equal pressure across the chip, and you've got your connections.
But doesn't
and
that, mean
that way, if you bend a pin, you're bending on a couple $100 motherboard instead of a $1,000 processor.
That's hilarious because the motherboard, of course, has so much more. You can see so much in the motherboard. You got all these connectors, all this stuff. You think it's more
expensive. Much more going on inside the chip.
But the processor is more expensive.
Yeah. So you're now using 1207 package, 1207 pads.
Is that the same thing as the Intel Core Duos use, or is it a different?
Now, the Core 2 Duos have 775.
Okay, so all different types of numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, these processors, you said that you can do a quad system with them. Does that mean that they're
the
quad
processors
on chip?
Are dual core a piece, and then you use two of these processors on a special motherboard built by ASUS.
And are these 64-bit processors?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. They run kind of hot. They're 90 nanometer. They're not the next generation of manufacturer technology yet. Those will be coming next year. I would check the website. It's going under QuadFX. AMD's pushing what's called megatasking. So they've got a superior memory architecture, and we'll talk about this with our guest today.
But
what this is supposed to allow people to do is to run more applications simultaneously and not have to take a performance hit because of it. So Yeah, I want to definitely want to talk about this architecture, now, QuadFX, with John today.
Okay, are these QuadFX chips out yet, or are they just announced?
Yeah, they're out.
Have you played with them yet?
They're out from system builders. The Asus and AMD fully plan on making these available. In fact, AMD is making it cost-effective. When you buy these chips, you'll buy them in bundles of two. And the high-end 3 gigahertz part will be around $1,000.
Is that comparable to other chips?
That's comparable to a quad-core
So AMD's doing some catch-up
Intel
now.
Chip, yeah.
All right. Well, speaking so frequently of John Stokes, co-founder and senior CPU editor of Ars Technica, a very well-respected magazine online about technology, specifically computers. He has a new book out called Inside the Machine, an illustrated introduction to microprocessors and computer architecture. John Stokes, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you calling in today and joining us. So have you played with the new AMD processors yet?
You know, I have not. I have not actually. I've done about what most people have and just really read the reviews and you know, what technical information I could get my hands on.
I recall, you know, talking about, I remember Sean talked about the Core 2s coming out and they're just amazing. And I got it, you know, but I didn't really get it. And so then we were playing benchmarks in the geek room, and it's really clear that, yeah, the Intel Core 2 are far superior to what AMD has on the market. Do you think this is going to be a turning point where AMD jumps ahead again?
Well, you know, it's really tough to say because I don't know what K8L looks like, you know, which they've apparently just demoed. That's their next generation.
That actually puts all four cores on the same chip.
And that's right. AMD's?
From AMD. Uh-huh.
And I don't really know. I mean, I think that it's, my sense is that in single-threaded performance, that the Core 2 Duo will probably retain a performance edge, especially, you know, at comparable clock speeds and price points. I mean, with the understanding that you can't really compare the clock speeds directly. You know, that's kind of not fair. But, right. I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk a bit about your book. You've been writing, you've been doing interviews and writing reviews about processors, motherboards for years, and this book is kind of a culmination of that knowledge. Would you classify that? Yeah. So are you like a processor engineer at heart? I mean, did you go to school doing this kind of thing, or have you just learned through osmosis with all these smart people?
No, I did an undergrad in computer engineering, and actually at the time I mostly focused on, I was mostly interested in programming and in software and stuff like this, and not so much in the hardware. And so then during my master's program, which was in a totally unrelated field, I started working on Ars with, you know, the other co-founders, and I found that you know, the hardware enthusiast community was actually really interesting. At that time, I knew that I didn't want to be a programmer, and that I wanted to write about tech.
How did you come to the conclusion that you didn't want to be a programmer?
Writing English is more fun.
I just didn't. You know, I looked at a lot of this was the .com boom, and I graduated from undergrad in 1998. And I just looked at a lot of the jobs that my fellow engineers were getting as coders, and it wasn't something that I wanted to do. They weren't building robots or nuclear missiles or something. They were going somewhere and programming access databases.
Right.
And that wasn't my bag.
So nuclear weapons were your bag?
Yeah. Well,
no, at least it'd be intellectually challenging.
You have to take over the world somehow.
All right, John, how does a computer work?
How does the computer work? Well,
read the book, isn't that the answer?
Yeah, exactly.
How'd you pick the short answer or the long answer?
Where'd you get the name Ars? What's that all about? Ars Technica,
the art of tech.
Well, we were all of us that started the site were master's students in the humanities
at Harvard, right?
At Harvard Divinity School, yeah.
Divinity School, the ghost in the machine. How perfect.
So we started out there, and we were all kind of like, a lot of us had different kinds of tech backgrounds, and then so for that reason we were working in the basement where the IT department was. And so, you know, I was working part-time, and so was Ken Fisher, and then Scott Watson, who's now at Tech Report, and some other folks were
I didn't realize Scott was there too.
Scott was a principal founder in the very beginning. He and Andy Brown, who was another co-founder and a friend of his, left pretty early on, I think in the first year, to found Tech Report.
Yeah, Tech Report's a good site.
Yeah, it's a great site. They do great hardware reviews. So,
So then you guys just formed Ars Technica.
Yeah, we formed it, and since we were all students of the ancient world and had all these dead languages under our belt and such, you know, we settled on this kind of odd name, you know, like it's sort of almost D&D inspired.
And can I quote you on that?
Sure, you can quote me on that. And it kind of caught on because it's a weird name, and it's the kind of thing that you think, oh, I wonder what that is, you know. And it works. It works for us. And so yeah, it's a sort of a Latin and Greek fusion. You know, art meaning, ars meaning art, and then technica, which is from the Greek word techne, which also means art. So if you were going to translate it literally, it would just mean art.
But that doesn't sound as cool.
Yeah, that's not that great. So
you guys have been, you were one of the first review sites, right?
We, a non-tech beat us. Tom's Hardware was earlier than us. Basically, when we started Anontech and Tom's, we're really starting to come into their own and gain a following. And so we started almost a year after those guys. So we were kind of a second wave.
How would you classify your readership?
Smart.
Wow. You know, it's really tough. And to be honest, our readership changes as the site changes and as the makeup of the writers change. And so the site has grown and the readership has grown. So, you know, it used to be, it was overclockers in the beginning and people who wanted to tweak and overclock. And so what we've done is, like, we'll retain that audience or a big portion of it and then add on, say, people who are interested in other issues and then wider tech issues. And so now it's kind of like the sort of broadly tech literate public and also people that work in the field and that have jobs in high technology and just, you know, programmers and stuff like this. And also we have kind of a diverse audience of other people who are into other things. Like, for instance, I did this series on electronic vote fraud, and so I did this article on how to steal an election. And I went and was supposed to speak at Georgetown Law School and present this article on how to steal an election. The weather didn't cooperate, and I got stuck on the runway at BWI during a really awful storm. But at any rate, so afterwards, I did meet the Georgetown folks, and I was really surprised there were a decent number of, like, lawyer types that were there that are regular Ars readers, because we cover things like voter fraud and Homeland Security and stuff like this.
And so, probably patents, software patents.
And legal stuff and all. You know, just so it's kind of a mix of stuff that we cover.
Has it been a challenge?
A mix of people. It's incredibly challenging, but you also learn a lot, you know, because you have to be able to teach yourself a lot about a topic really quickly and then write something coherent.
How about defending the inclusion of political commentary on a technical site?
Well, you know,
I mean, it is your content and your site, and you can say what you want, right?
Yeah, but it's still our site. I mean, we own it. We can say whatever we like.
You have a responsibility to your readers.
Right. That having been said, we have to. We have to walk a line, and so we have to decide on the back end, like, how important is this? And so, for instance, like coverage of the NSA wiretapping scandal. You know, I did most of that coverage. Although a lot of other people did some very good posts on it for the site. And it's always a question of, like, how much of this scandal do we want to cover? Because, you know, we could just devote a whole section of the site for a stretch of the time when these stories are popping up.
John, do you take these stories and look at them from a technical perspective of how they're implemented and how they work? Or are you doing the same type of thing that New York Times is doing?
I'm trying to do both, actually. Mm-hmm. In some posts, I'll do my dead-level best to give, like, just as dig out as much technical detail on something like the wiretapping program as I possibly can, and maybe offer some hypotheses for how it works and stuff like this. And then in other ones, I'll step back and I'll try to take a look at the broader policy implications.
Right. All right. Well, John, let me start asking some stuff about processors. I understand quite a bit about processors, but I want to ask you some things that I think come up. We talk about them all the time, and people don't necessarily understand them. And maybe you have some good metaphors that you've used in your book. Can you explain what a pipeline is that the processing inside a microprocessor and how that works?
Sure. The metaphor that I use in the book is an assembly line metaphor. And a pipeline is essentially just an assembly line for instructions, where an instruction starts out in one phase and it gets worked on, and then it goes to the next phase.
You mean like an like an assembly line, like making a phone and or you know, making a doll, and so one person sews on the clothes and one person stuffs the doll with foam, and then the next person puts the head on? That kind of
exactly.
Okay.
So with a pipeline, one phase will fetch the instruction from the cache, and the next phase will decode it into the processor's internal instruction format, and then the next phase will decide when and where it should be executed, and then send it off for execution. And so that way you can stack. You can have multiple instructions in different phases of execution at once, and that's a form of parallelism.
Now, do you mean you have multiple pipelines, or do you have you start instruction and then there's another instruction? So like the same pieces, one person's putting a doll together and the next person down is putting a G.I. Joe and so on?
Exactly. You have multiple pipelines and multiple stages in each pipeline. So you can have quite a bit of different instructions of different kinds in flight, at once.
Now, what are the tools to these pieces of the processor? I mean, what is instruction when it really comes down to it? What is that one node, if you will, of the pipeline doing? Are we talking about multiplication? Are we talking about square root? What does it do?
Another set of analogies or class of analogies that I like to use are fast food analogies mm-hmm. and supermarket analogies because they present different kinds of queuing problems. And so an instruction is almost like a request for a service. It's like an order that you want to have filled. You may have an order for a Big Mac and two Cokes, and then the guy behind you has an order for just fries. And so you can have different queues, which would be different pipelines, that are populated with these different kinds of orders. Uh-huh. And you have different people on the back end that can fill them. So I'm maybe this is a stretch, but if McDonald's had one line for certain kinds of food, another line for certain kinds of things. And so basically you have different hardware in the processor's core, and this hardware takes in, for instance, integer instructions, integer additions. Another execution unit may take in integer multiplications. Another deals with floating point. Another deals with vector.
In that fast food analogy, it would be equivalent to one of the employees being a specialist in making the Oreo shake. And so whenever an Oreo shake comes, that person handles it because they're the best at doing
exactly.
it.
So there'd
be
exactly.
one piece. Okay.
So you hand it off to this Oreo shake guy, and he goes and he makes the shake.
What's, John, to get a little more, to do some more buzzwords to some degree, what's the difference between L1 cache and L2 cache?
The L1 cache is smaller. It's closer to the instruction registers or to the registers. It's closer to the actual execution units, and so it's faster to access. It's also a more expensive, like in terms of cost per bit, than L2 cache.
And it seems to be a way that processor companies can take up the real estate that's being created as they shrink the cores down, right? We're seeing
exactly.
more and more L2 cache put on a chip.
Exactly. Well, L2 cache is the best way because for L1 cache sizes, I mean, these are actually a little bit more fixed and bounded than you might think. I mean, you really, there's kind of no point in like a 1 megabyte L1 cache, for instance, because
the bigger
caches get, the higher their access latencies are. So it takes more time to look up information in a really huge cache and then get it to the instruction or to the execution unit than it does in a smaller cache. So with the L1, you really want to tune it to the right size, so that it's small enough to be very fast, but then it holds enough information to be useful. Now with the L2, you can just kind of go nuts and you can dump a lot of transistors into L2 and you can get a great return.
Okay. I want to come back to this.
Okay, we will. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. We're talking about John Stokes, author of Inside the Machine, an illustrated look at microprocessors and computers, and from Ars Technica, and we're taking your calls and questions right now on technology. Anything you'd like to ask us? John's also very familiar with electronic voting, anything technical, really. He's another geek that's got some expertise on everything. And if you're lost on our L2, L1 cash discussion, please ask us something else that's more applicable to what you want to know. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out those numbers in just one more second. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Drew Meyer, Sean Cleveland, and Miles Elam. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering DSL broadband, computer rentals, and tune-ups. Cruise.io has retail stores in downtown Santa Cruz and Watsonville. More information can be found at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. Back to our conversation with John Stokes. Drew, I believe you have a question.
Well, I hate to sidetrack us here, and I love a deep cash conversation as much as the next geek, but John, you've got an interesting perspective because you're a Chicago area resident, is that right? And you don't have to say that if you don't want to, never mind.
I am.
I learned that by reading on your blog, so I assume it's public. And there's a really nice conversation about the voting machines and the experience that you had voting in your precincts. So could you share a little bit about that and what you ended up discovering about what was going on voting in your area?
Yeah, I went to vote, and the touchscreen machine in my precinct was frozen, and so I had to use the optical scan ballot. My wife was registered in a different precinct because we just got married this past August, and so her residence that was listed with the county was like a few blocks over at her previous place. And so she voted in a separate precinct, and like the touchscreen machine was working there, and so she really liked it. And I wanted a chance to use it. It was a Sequoia machine, but it was apparently frozen. The voter card was stuck in there, and they couldn't get it out. And I talked to one of the volunteers, and she said that this was a pretty widespread problem in Cook County, that she had talked to a lot of other people, and these touchscreen machines were frozen. Luckily, we were able to have an election because they had optical scan machines there, and so they were just handing out optical scan ballots and letting us use those. The problems in Cook County weren't nearly, you know, what they were in some other places, like Cuyahoga County, Ohio, or, Florida District 13, the House District 13, that whole thing that's going on right now, that's disputed. There were apparently a lot of problems in Arkansas. My experience with the optical scan machines was pretty pleasant. I like them. I think they're good machines. They can be compromised just like anything else, but the key is that you can audit these machines. Because okay. I actually did mark up a paper ballot before it can be retrieved.
Right. Okay, cool. Thank you for your update on voting. I think that's kind of cool to hear a technical perspective. I didn't get to play with electronic
voting. Let's get
voting
back
system.
To Chip.
Sean's dying over here. I'm sorry. I rerouted the conversation.
What's your question, Sean?
I remember John wrote a book about processors. So I kind of want to.
I think his blog is good, too. All right, let's hear some more about
cash. Burning cycles, man. Do it.
All right, so Intel and AMD are moving chips into smaller and smaller designs, manufacturing scales. So we're at 90 nanometers, going down to 65, even lower. And they're talking about adding more and more processing cores. Where's this going? So right now we got 2, we're going to 4. You know, Intel has mentioned 72 at some point. I mean, is this really the right way to go, do you think?
Yeah, it's really tough to say because I get the feeling that, you know, the way that things are now, Intel may have some idea about what a 72-core chip looks like. And then someone at, say, Microsoft may have some idea about what a 72-core chip is like. But ultimately, there are prototypes, you know, academic prototypes of these massively multi-core chips. And such as this, but like really, it's all kind of murky. It's difficult to really look and see. I mean, this is why Intel, for instance, has asked for help from the industry in design and benchmarks, because they want to they want a way to bring software vendors into the loop on chip design,
right?
To a certain extent, because they need to think with operating system vendors and with application writers about where all this is going. It's not just a case where Intel cranks up the clock speed again or delivers better single-threaded performance and then everybody's happy.
Yeah, there's got to be software that takes...
Everybody has to actually talk a bit more.
Well, John, if we're talking about making software better for the chip, what about this whole legacy x86 system that we're in?
I know.
And this explosion of graphics chips that are specialized and very powerful, but they're not fitting in the x86 architecture. What do you think about that, the more specialized chips?
I I go back and forth because I think that there was a time when I, you know, for the past 20-something years, ISA hasn't really mattered. The instruction set architecture hasn't mattered. It's all been process-driven. As long as Intel could deliver process shrinks on a schedule and deliver single-threaded performance improvements, mostly from clock speed and then some architectural tricks, it didn't really matter, you know, what ISA that we had settled on, which is essentially x86 for most of the world. So now we're kind of out of that phase where we don't have a free ride from the process folks anymore. And so I think the question that I think about is now that there's been this kind of rupture and we're no longer on this process-driven train, and software is really a performance factor in a way that it hasn't necessarily been for the past 20 years or so. Like, will ISA matter? And I don't know. I mean, I can't. The problem is deeper, I guess, what I'm trying to say, is than just the fact that, well, you have these specialized graphics coprocessors that have one instruction set architecture, and then you have the main CPU that has another instruction set architecture, and on.
And then Intel pushed they came out with Itanium, and that just a whole new design. And it didn't go where they expected it to. Do you think that really is going to hinder, you know, that idea of a new design in the future?
Well, I think that the problems with Itanium may be more specific to Itanium and to VLIW and to the specifics of that project.
So you think Intel or AMD may come out with some revolutionary concept in the future, or are they just going to continue pouring more of the older cores into their dies? You know?
I think that right now, if we're just talking about instruction set architecture, just, you know, to isolate that factor, the money is in x86 code, and then making the existing x86 code base and all the tools and all that stuff go faster.
Right.
And an ISA transition is painful, and it's just not ever going to happen, I don't think, for the entire industry. And so
okay.
we're stuck with that ISA.
That's a good future statement. I like that. I'm gonna back you up on that and quote you on that. But I agree with you 100%. I think that we're stuck in the
x86. Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah. I think the only thing we're going to see is that we're going to see software manufacturers, specifically game people, doing a lot more on the GPU, and therefore more specialized processing being used, but probably kind of copying the GPU format. So, in any case, let's go on to take some calls because I think we're getting too technical to some degree. But I like it. John from Big Sur, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question today?
Yes. I have a PowerBook. It's a Lombard G3 333. And on startup, it has a cache error warning. And it doesn't indicate whether or not it's L1 or L2. But I can send this thing in and have it upgraded to a G4 433 with two extra chips, 256 chips.
How much will it cost you?
Well, under $600.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Nah.
Not worth it, huh?
Nah. I don't think so. I think you can get a $600 G4 laptop on eBay.
Yeah, huh.
And if you spend $1,000, you can get a brand new Intel laptop.
Right.
So
right.
Why would you want, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Even though you're attached to it, I get that.
Right, because it's been a good computer.
Yeah, what operating system are you running on it?
Well, it's just 9.2.2.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You need to move.
Get a new machine. It'll be a Christmas present to yourself or a New Year's present to yourself.
All right.
I mean, if you're thinking about spending $600, think more seriously about spending more like $1,000.
Uh-huh.
That's my take on it. I don't recommend updating laptops, processors.
Okay.
Putting more memory in a laptop, fine. But at some point, it's just not a good return. Geeks, you guys agree?
I totally agree.
I agree.
And in fact, for that amount of money, you shouldn't be getting something that's like a less than a 500 megahertz box. You should be getting something closer to 1 gigahertz or faster.
Okay.
There you go. Thank you so much for the call.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Bye, John. So that was John from Big Sur. If you'd like to call in with questions and comments of technology, we're taking anything right now. You can call us about any technology questions you'd like. Specifically, if you'd really like to talk to us about processors, we'd love to, because we have a specialist from Ars Technica, one of the founders, with a new book out, John Stark's Inside the Machine, an Illustrated Introduction to Microprocessors and Computer Architecture. You're welcome to call us now with questions and comments. Phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, nice and slow, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. 7-7.
Yeah, this book really lays open just what a processor is and how it works.
It's approachable, isn't it?
Yeah, I look at the table of contents and just the layout. You really take it from the beginning and then to the various different processor technologies. What was your focus for this book?
I wanted to fit everything together in a way that was useful. I found as an undergrad in computer engineering that you go and you take a digital logic course, and so then you know how to build a 4-bit adder from NAND gates, and you don't necessarily know what virtual memory is or what a pipeline is or mm-hmm. something like this. And so you can go all the way into your senior year in engineering and not really have that much of a grasp on how it all fits together, how the pieces fit together, how a machine actually boots up, how it really handles code and data. And so the book started as a way for me to write the kind of book that I would have wanted to have had as an undergraduate computer person, a book that could sort of step back and give a big picture and then sort of take step by step, this is kind of the stuff that you need to know.
Yeah, I really like your chapters on taking processors and just looking at a certain processor, and I really like this Pentium versus Motorola G4 section, because there's this whole divide among different processors, and of course, especially with Apple's move to Intel processors, it's kind of like that whole technology was abandoned. So I like to see the ideas behind what's happened and where the processors have gone. You kind of do a history of them. What do you think about the whole dropping of G5 or, Motorola's technology?
Well, I was, on the one hand, I liked the 970, and I was enthused about Cell and the other things that IBM had coming down the pike. Yeah. But I also was just kind of, tired of the situation where Apple tries to sprint and then leap out ahead of the x86 world, and then they fall behind. And then something else happens a few years later, and they leap out ahead, and then they kind of steadily fall behind. Because it's a tortoise and the hare type situation, I suppose, whereas Intel is just kind of steadily chugging along and delivering incremental and regular performance improvements. And then Apple, for their part, comes out with this fancy stuff, and then it stagnates, and they do something else. And so now I think that I was pleased with the transition, actually. Ultimately, I was quite happy with it. And I look forward to picking up a MacBook Pro.
And running what on it?
Well, I look forward to picking up a MacBook Pro and running Adobe Illustrator on it, but Adobe Illustrator is not currently a universal binary, and I hear that it runs awfully under Rosetta. And so I'm going to be stuck with my PowerBook G4 until Adobe can get their act together and port to Intel.
I didn't know you were a Mac user.
I am. I've been a Mac user since OS X. I bought it just for jollies. I bought a PowerBook G4 667 megahertz just to check it out and to play with OS X, and this is a few years back. And I retained Windows on my main desktop, and I just kind of steadily got into it. And then my Windows machine died, and I never bothered to replace it. And wow. So now the only thing I use is a PowerBook. And that's what I did the book on, and that's what I've done all my work for ours for the past 5 years or so on, is a PowerBook.
Wow. I didn't know that. Cool. Yeah. Let's go ahead and take another call from Scotts Valley. Jeffrey, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, Jeffrey. What's your question today?
Well, my computer got stolen out of my office last night, so I'm going to buy a computer today, a laptop, and I think regrettably committed to the Wintel line. And I'm wondering what you guys think about what I should be shopping for.
Do you need to pick it up today, or can you mail order it?
It's awfully expensive to be without it for any length of time, but give me both options, and maybe I'll have to figure out what to do about it.
Hey, Johnny, I'd like to hear what you have to say. Let me have you on.
I don't really have a good opinion on that, because I just kind of buy right now whatever the latest thing that Apple puts out. So I haven't been in the market for a Wintel laptop since my wife bought a Dell 3 years ago.
Sean, what happens if today you get fired from NVIDIA and you have to buy a laptop? What would you go do?
I've got plenty of computers at home, so
you wouldn't need a laptop.
I think I would need one, but if I were to buy one, I would do a lot of research. A lot of research first. It just so happens that a really close friend of mine bought a notebook from Alienware, and he loves it. He just keeps raving about it. So I would look into that.
Jeffrey, you're kind of cutting out. Alienware is a
high-end
arm
PC.
Of Dell now.
It's a gaming PC focus, though.
They're very functional, they're well known for that.
But they make enthusiast level notebooks that have a little more processing power and graphics power than typical notebooks.
Are they being stocked?
That may not be what you need. I think Dell or HP would probably do you just fine. Dell or HP, I think, make great notebooks.
Or Lenovo and the IBM ThinkPad series.
Yeah, I like ThinkPads personally in terms of the Wintel line.
ThinkPads?
Yeah.
What I would do, because you want to buy it right now, and I always recommend this, go find a place that has a whole bunch of laptops stocked and try them out and see what you feel best.
Best Buy has a great assortment of laptops that you can actually play with each one of them. Fry's has a ton.
Definitely take a look at it. The thing is, making a purchase in one day is never, with this kind of a cost, is never really a great thing to do to yourself.
Is this going
to
be portable, or is it going to be just set on your desk and stay plugged in?
It's portable.
Yeah.
So you do need a notebook, then.
You know what? I would look for more of a business class notebook, because they tend to be made better.
This is going to be a spreadsheet and word processing machine.
Yeah. But just for the sturdiness of the notebook, The business class notebooks are made of better materials than the consumer grade, typically.
Okay.
All right, good luck on your purchase, Jeffrey. I'm sorry about the theft. That's a horrible experience to have.
Yeah. I also would like some advice on how to cast hexes on thieves.
Sorry, say that again?
I didn't really get
that. How to cast hexes on thieves.
Cast hexes on thieves.
Yes.
We'll have a hex show coming up in the next few weeks.
Give them a virus, I guess. You know what? Your thieves have a Windows machine, so I think that's enough of a hex. Thank you so much for the call, Jeffrey.
Yeah, geeks by nature aren't very superstitious.
No, we should be more, don't you think? Be more humorous. All right, another question.
I did a fair amount of prayer when I was coding.
Please compile. That's because you're a bad coder.
Please.
Okay, so from Santa Cruz, Mary, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, are you there?
We are. What's your question today, Mary?
Thanks for talking about processors and things like that. Now I'm going to give you a chance to answer an incredibly simple question that I can't figure out. I am a PC user. I have a longtime friend who's just starting to use computers, and she has an Apple. And so I'm having trouble talking to her on the phone, figuring out the keyboard stuff. And I do a lot of things with a right-click in my Windows program. Where the hell is the right-click on an Apple?
Okay, there is one. It's on every Macintosh, and this is how you do it. You hold down the control key on the keyboard, and you click.
Yes.
So when you're going to click something on a Macintosh, if you don't have a right button mouse on, and I'd recommend buying a right mouse for this friend, just hold the control button down, the CTRL button down, and click, and you will get a contextual menu just like on a Windows machine when you right click.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome so much.
Okay.
And by the way, what you're doing is very noble. It's a hard thing to do when you support an operating system without it in front of you.
There are still people who are way back at the beginning. So.
Yeah, just learning.
Okay.
Thank you so much
for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye,
Mary. Bye-bye.
So, John?
Yes?
I've gone through the cycle of Mac to Windows, Windows to Mac, I think three different times, and I'm currently on a Macintosh. But it is so wonderful to use the serious processing power of a high-end Windows machine, and I don't have the kind of money to get a high-end Macintosh machine. Are you surrounded by, saying you're running on a G4 still, aren't you surrounded at Ars Technica with a whole bunch of people with just amazing systems that can crack through Photoshop like nobody's business, and you're sitting just clicking away?
a lot of our guys have access to a lot of horsepower, and some of the guys that we have that do tech stuff for us also have side gigs at hosting companies, where they can get their hands on a lot of different kinds of machines. But I went through a phase where, I was interested in tweaking and having the latest and the greatest processor. And at some point I decided that I was tired of fixing computers and I wanted to start using them. And I just couldn't take it anymore. And so I've just kind of actually that's that's not really true. I mean, I got into the Mac thing, and when I realized that I could use OS X and have a minimum of downtime and maintenance and, like, kind of, you know, hassle with different kinds of stuff, I just sort of stuck with it from inertia.
Okay.
And I can't, like, really, like, the thought of building a system just kind of stresses me. Like, I'm going to build one this summer to play games on.
So you do games.
I haven't gamed in a while, but I've got a lot of catching up to do.
So, moving forward, you know, all these processors have 64-bit ability. Is that the way to go? Do you see every consumers moving to 64-bit OS, especially with Vista?
Yeah, I think it's the way to go simply because you can get sort of, economies of scale with these things. It's not that consumers are going to need a 64-bit OS. It's just that it's just cheaper for Microsoft to make a 64-bit OS and sell it to everybody.
Rather than two. And what's the difference between, like, AMD's original try at 64 and Intel's original try at 64? And why did we kind of migrate to one type of way of doing it?
You know, Ken tried to get an article on me out of possible differences, if any, between the Intel 64-bit implementation and the AMD one. And, like, I never really looked into it that closely. My understanding is that there's, like, a few minor things that are different about it, but for the most part, Intel just kind of took what AMD did and ran with it.
that's what I recalled happening. But they did have a solution at first. It just wasn't backwards compatible.
Oh, you mean Itanium?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's still blowing going. I mean, this is kind of a little known fact that Itanium sales continue to pick up, and it's a very profitable niche market.
Who's the market?
Big Iron and people that need just insane floating point performance, which is what you get with the Itanium workstation. It's high performance computing. You know, the same people that are kind of buying.
The latest
power thing from IBM. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to invite some more people to call in. We're talking with John Stokes. He's Hannibal at Ars Technica, one of the founders, and the CPU editor. And we also have in the air room Drew Meyer, who's a specialist in, among other things, storage, remote storage. We have Miles Elam, who's a coder in Java and a proponent of open source, along with Drew. And we also have Sean Cleveland, former author and editor at Boot and Maximum PC magazines and current employee of NVIDIA and a specialist in the hardware realm. And we can take any questions you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800 and toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. And please don't be shy. You can ask us anything. We probably won't help you, but you can definitely ask.
All right. We should point out that there is a free downloadable trial. Let's say you can get a chapter or so of the book at No Starch Press, which is nostarch.com. There's a little
you can actually go to geekspeak.org and click on the book title.
Super.
From
well.
There.
Oh, thank you.
And
also,
actually, yes.
May, we're selling it through ours. We're selling signed copies.
Oh, really?
That's cool.
Just put that up. The URL just went live this morning. It's store.arstechnica.com. The page is kind of primitive. We're still tweaking it. Because we're switching to different software, e-commerce software that lets us do, we can take credit cards.
Uh-huh.
And so we have about 250 signed copies of the book that we're going to sell through ours.
And who is all signing it?
I'm signing it.
Just yourself. Yeah. So is your hand tired yet?
I haven't signed them yet. I'm actually going to fly out to Boston and take a little weekend vacation and then go sign 250 books.
Are you gonna number them too?
No, just sign them.
Okay. Oh, man, you got to number them. Then you can keep the first five and sell them later when they go up in price. Okay, so we got a question from Watsonville. Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello, Mike. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question today?
I'm getting ready to buy a new PC.
Excellent.
And I hear all this stuff coming out in January and all of that. Should I wait or...
Well, you know, Christmas time is not the best time to buy a computer.
Especially with Vista coming out in January.
All the companies have really come out with the new hardware, but, of course, prices are going to be, you know...
Astronomical?
Well, I don't know. You could find deals. I think...
But the thing is, the trick is here, if you're going to buy a machine, you can wait till late January or February and actually get Vista installed on it.
That's true.
So isn't that better than upgrading?
But then, you know, you've got time off in the holidays...
Oh, that's true. You can
it'd
play
be
with
cool
it.
To just sit with a new computer. I mean, it's up to you.
Depends how much you need it, Mike.
What are you going to use this computer for? Because that really determines the type of hardware that you get.
Oh, I surf the net and things like that, edit photos and stuff like that.
Okay.
I'm not a big gamer.
Are you using Photoshop?
I use Picasa, too, by Google.
Yeah, that's nice. It's free, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a Photoshop, but I found that that Picasa is a lot easier to use.
So what do you want to know?
I just want to know what can I get the most bang for my buck. I was looking at those HP computers with the media centers.
Are you planning on watching a lot of television on it?
Not really.
Then you don't need.
But I might center. Because they just took my dish away from me. My Vista network channel. So, but no, I'm not planning on watching TV.
I wouldn't. If you're not planning on really doing TV watching on your machine, I wouldn't get media center necessarily just because of that. But then again, there's not much of a price difference. Sean, you got a recommendation on this? You've played with media center, or John? Do you have a recommendation?
No, I don't. I mean,
yeah.
I use the
Your Mac.
Mini.
Yeah, I know.
So this new Vista, is it everything is cracked up to be, or
you know what? We don't know yet, but there's a lot of issues with it. But if you're about to buy a new computer, you can get it. You can get it a computer that will run Vista very well, and Vista's going to have a better security system.
You know, I was playing with the media center capabilities of Vista this week.
Okay.
And they're really nice.
I talked to you guys a couple of weeks ago. I was trying out this Ubuntu operating system.
Did you give up on it?
No, I didn't.
Oh, good.
I finally got it to work, and it worked fine. And
actually,
I like it a lot better than Windows. It's a lot simpler, and all the buttons are right there on the screen all the time, so you can just switch between programs really
easy.
Sure. So if I get a new machine, it'll have the Vista on it. Will it interfere? If I want to put Ubuntu on it, will I have a problem doing
that? No, you'll be okay.
You shouldn't.
And here's what you can do. Dell is actually offering a rebate program for people who have to buy Windows on their machine but not going to use it. You can then buy the system with Vista on it. And if you're not going to use Vista and you don't open the software license agreement, you can have Dell rebate you the amount of the license fee for Windows, and then you can run Ubuntu on it.
But then, of course, you wouldn't have Vista anymore.
But John, but for hardware, I think you don't need to get the most cutting-edge processor. So don't spend a lot of money on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Memory is going to be more important for you.
Right.
I don't think I would get an integrated graphics chip. Get a card and look for a good deal.
Mike, thank you for the call. Sorry, we do have to wrap up the show a little bit. And John Stokes, I want to thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak today. I hope to have you on again because I think you're a great great voice and a great intelligence and fun to speak with.
We need to push people to Ars Technica. It's
and
a great site.
I think we do. ArsTechnica.com is the site. You can find it just by going to geekspeak.org. John Stokes on Ars, you can find him as Hannibal. He's one of the co-founders. And his book is Inside the Machine, An Illustrated Introduction to Microprocessors and Computer Architecture. And you can get a signed copy right now by going to Ars Technica and going to store. John, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Hey, thank you guys. I enjoyed it.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics. Offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services, Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. Geeks, thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Yep, you bet.
We also had some support on Instant Messenger from Dee Dee and Alex. Thank you so much for joining us virtually. And every week we have Rick Philman answering the phones for us. Wonderful guy. And if you ever call in, he's the guy that answers the phone. Thank you very much, Rick, for making the show what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out because you, the audience, wouldn't be able to call in and talk to us and ask us questions that we confuse and amaze you with. Or something like that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Next week on our show, we're going to be talking about 3D graphics, specifically making your own character, a character that you design, and implementing it into a game. So it should be a fun show. And Sean, I think you've got some shows in the pipeline as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I should probably work on those.
Yeah, I think
We've got some cool guests coming on.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo, on the web at KUSP.org. Coming up next is Castle Cottage, but first we're going to have the Slow County Report. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned.